In 2019, Broward beaches had few swim advisories, even though Palm Beach and Miami-Dade had many. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Both Palm Beach and Miami-Dade counties had a combined 200 days of advisories because there were high levels of waste in the water. But were Broward beaches cleaner, or did officials just not do enough to warn the residents? Also, President Trump recently gave clemency to some controversial figures. One of them is a South Florida woman who was arrested for scamming Medicare of tens of millions of dollars. Who was she? And Sundial went to the Museum of Discovery and Science for their new exhibit on dinosaurs. It's also teaching kids about climate change.
Climate is what happens over long periods of time, decades, millennia, eons.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. President Trump recently gave clemency to 11 people. One of them was former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who was a little more than halfway through his 14-year sentence for his pay-for-play charges. He was found to offer up President Barack Obama's Senate seat. Also on that list is a Hialeah woman named Judith Negron. She was charged and sentenced for 35 years for her role in a Medicare fraud scheme that bilked the government of $200 million. Let's talk about this story with Jay Weaver, an investigative reporter with the Miami Herald. Jay, great to have you.
Thank you, Lewis.
At the center of the story, Jay, is this company called American Therapeutic Corporation. It's a medical chain of clinics. Tell me a little bit about what sort of services this company was providing.
Well, to understand the criminal enterprise of American Therapeutic, you have to understand that Miami is the capital of Medicare fraud in the United States, dating back to the early 2000 era. And in brief, what we saw here was a rolling activity of different types of criminal scams, starting with durable medical equipment. And then you had HIV infusion therapy scams. Then you had home health care scams. And then it rolled into the mental health scams. These were group sessions offered by different mental health professionals at clinic settings outside a hospital on a month or two-month basis. And the scam here was is that the patients were all bought and paid for. They really weren't even victims themselves. Maybe some were, but they were all recruited by patient recruiters who were controlled by a man named Larry Duran and his cadre of assistants, including Judith Negron.
Help me understand what patient recruits are.
Well, it would be like this, Lewis. It would be like I receive so much money from Medicare. Let's say it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars in payments for basically for services that are not even provided, paid for by the taxpayer-funded healthcare program. I take a portion of that money and I kick it back to you so you can go out and find patients, usually senior citizens, but in this case, people who have disability insurance under the Social Security and Medicare system, and you pay them. You pay them in beer, you pay them in drugs, you pay them in rent, you pay them in a variety of ways. They're all living in halfway houses, very sympathetic people. These are people that have real difficult lives. You know, they have addictions, they have mental health problems. So you as a recruiter literally pay them $500, $600 to use their Medicare card so they can be used for the purposes of these healthcare clinics, these mental health care clinics. And they basically then turn around and bill the government for services that aren't even provided. And if they are, they don't need them. And it's because they are of no good. These people come in and eat lunch. They watch videos. They come, they go. They really don't receive any services at all. And Larry Duran and his group of assistants, including Judith Negron, charged the government upwards of $200 million over several years at seven clinics from Miami up to Boca Raton. And doctors prescribe all this. It's all done. I mean, there is such a network of this activity in South Florida, but particularly in Miami. And this was the one This was the crime du jour during this period. It was back about a decade or so. We don't see so much of it now.
All right. And Judith Negron, and I apologize, I mispronounced her name. Judith Negron, what was her role in how all of this, what did the government claim she was doing?
Well, American Therapeutic was the parent company. And there was a company called Medilink, if I remember correctly, the exact name. And it was a subsidiary of American Therapeutic. She, Judith Negron, ran Medilink, and they siphoned monies from American Therapeutic through Medilink to any variety of people. It could be back to her, back to Larry Duran, back to others who were involved in the scam. The money could go to patient recruiters. It could go to patients. It could go to doctors writing falsified prescriptions, authorizing the patients to receive services at these mental health clinics. And so her business was really a money laundering entity. And she was convicted of 24 counts of conspiracy, kickbacks, all kinds of things that you can, typically see in a healthcare scam.
She kept claiming that she didn't know anything about the scheme, but what was her defense? I mean, we're talking again, over $200 million.
Well, first of all, there were about a dozen or more of these defendants, and each one had different responsibilities, and ultimately they all pled guilty. Some of them cooperated. Some of them received less sentences. She didn't get the worst sentence. Larry Duran got 50 years. His girlfriend, who was also the director of one of the main clinics, she got 35 years. Judith Negron got 35 years, but she's the only one who went to trial. So she suffered what they call a trial tax. Rather than cooperate and just plead guilty, she was offered 10 years on a conspiracy count. She ended up going to trial and just got clobbered on all 24 counts. The judge was totally unsympathetic. And back in that day, and it continues to this day, judges were just hammering defendants in the Medicare fraud rackets. There have been thousands of these types of defendants in Miami. I mean, it is literally ground zero, billions of dollars lost as a result of these kind of schemes. So she's very lucky to have her sentence commuted by President Trump.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Jay Weaver. Last week, the Trump administration commuted the criminal sentences of a number of high-profile white-collar criminals, including Judith Negron from Hialeah. You can read more about the story at WLRN.org. Jay, why? You were talking about judges were hammering down on these kinds of cases. Legal scholars had said, 35 years was a lot. But why were they doing that? Why were judges doing that?
Not just legal scholars. I think any reasonable person would think that a nonviolent first-time offender who commits fraud of this nature, should be looking at a sentence more in the 10 to 15-year range. The reason why this was so bad, though, was because it was a shock to the conscience. They billed $200 million. They received almost $85 million in payments, and the racket had gone on for a very long time. And so judges were just fed up with these types of defendants. I mean, you were seeing scores of doctors, businessmen, and women. You were seeing, patient recruiters working for them. I mean, these were organized rackets that were going on in our community. So the judges really started hammering. And not only that, there were a lot of them that were fleeing before they were charged or during the course of their criminal activity. They'd flee to Cuba, they'd flee to Spain. So there was this incredible just sense of outrage. And there are several judges who routinely give out 20, 30-year sentences for Medicare fraud. So even though it seemed like an outlier, it really wasn't that outside the norm of some of these big Medicare fraud cases.
And Negron had spent 8 years of her 35 years before getting, getting her sentence commuted. What do we know about what she said about her time in jail, in prison?
Well, I did not speak with her personally, but the AP did speak with her. And obviously, she is extremely grateful. She had done good deeds while she was in prison. She was in a Central Florida prison. She had met someone who, by the name of Alice Johnson, who had been serving a life sentence for drug trafficking. And this woman caught the attention of President Trump originally, and he commuted her sentence for time served at that point. It might have been a decade or more. And that woman turned around and you know, told Trump about Judith Negron. And then Kim Kardashian, of all people, you know, the celebrity host on TV, she ended up promoting Judith Negron's cause. And so people took up her cause in a way that you wouldn't typically see. I mean, the other commutations and pardons that occurred last week were more of a political nature. Negron apparently didn't have that kind of juice. In fact, you know, she's a modest woman from a modest family in Hialeah, and she somehow just caught the attention of this Alice Johnson, who, you know, had her own sentence commuted, and then she had the benefit of Kim Kardashian taking up her cause. And so the president just embraced her, and it was totally inadvertent. She got lucky. But many people think that 8 years was enough. And, you know, I sense that for what she did, it could have been anywhere between 8 and 15 years. 35 years was obviously excessive.
So the clemency announcement comes as Fort Lauderdale resident and longtime GOP strategist Roger Stone is facing up to 40 months in prison. But how closely are people in South Florida watching his story, his upcoming sentence, and the potential, again, for the president to decide, you know what, I'm going to help this guy out?
Well, Roger Stone needs no introduction. Unlike Judith Negron, he has been a friend of Trump's, an insider in the Republican Party since his youth as a Nixon supporter back in the 60s. He is one of a kind. A lot of people view him as a creep, a clown, but he's a pretty savvy guy, and he loves the attention, and he's pugnacious as hell. And before trial, even during trial, even after trial, he was still punching away verbally and otherwise, you know, at the establishment. Trump came to his aid when he saw that the line prosecutors in the case were recommending 7 to 9 years for his offense. You know, the belief was is that maybe it should have been, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 years. The prosecutors, you know, all got up and quit the case when they were overruled by their own department, the Department of Justice and AG William Barr, you know, where he recommended through a prosecutor in his office for a lower sentence, didn't specify the length of time. And lo and behold, the judge, who, you know, rightly condemned Stone's crime, you know, gave him 3 years and 4 months. And so she probably got it about right. But at the same time, you know, he was just a really difficult defendant, and that's putting it charitably.
And we'll see how this all plays out, because it's not over yet. Again, talking with the Miami Herald's Jay Weaver. Again, the story of Hialeah woman Judith Negron. Again, her 35-year sentence commuted by President Trump just recently. Jay, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
You're welcome, Lewis.
And again, you could follow more on that story reporting from the Miami Herald at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, are Broward officials doing enough to close beaches or warn people about the dangers in the ocean water? More on that coming up. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Another day in Fort Lauderdale and another sewage pipe break. Today's break was in the neighborhood of George English Park near an elementary school. There has been a reported 211 million gallons of raw sewage in Fort Lauderdale streets and waterways in just the last 2 months. And that may be having consequences well beyond the city. An investigation by the Sun Sentinel last week found that there were unsafe levels of bacteria in Broward's beaches 25 times over the course of 2019. But the number of times that beaches were closed in Broward or swim advisories were issued was a lot fewer. Mike Scully is the treasurer of the Broward chapter of the Surfrider Foundation. He regularly tests the water quality for the organization. Mike, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you all.
Also joining us is Brooke Badinger. She's the Sun Sentinel reporter behind the investigation. Brooke, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Brooke, we're all aware of the Fort Lauderdale sewage problems, but when did you first become aware of the issue with the water quality at the beaches in Broward County?
Back in the summertime, I started looking into this because we noticed that we were seeing a lot of, you know, these advisories coming out of Palm Beach County, and, you know, you'd see it in Miami-Dade too. But we noticed that we weren't seeing any of that in Broward County, and just kind of started wondering why, because we knew they had, you know, issues with their sewer systems and, you know, even, you know, that lot of stuff going on even back then. So, yeah, I just started looking into it and asking some of these questions.
Looking over the data by the health department, how many times was the water considered to have unsafe levels of bacteria, and how many closures or advisories were offered up?
Yeah, it was almost 200. It was about 180 times, according to the health departments in South Florida. And they don't, you know, close the beaches, but they tell you about the level of bacteria, and then, you know, they'll issue the advisory. So it was 74 total advisories. You know, it was 33 in Palm, 39 in Miami, and 2 in Broward, and that was in the last 10 days of the year.
So, Mike, you're the one out there testing the water for the Surf Rider Foundation. What are you testing in the water? What are you looking for?
We're looking for Enterococcus primarily as a fecal indicator bacteria. If that's present, then we know that there's other bacteria.
And how often do you go out there and do that?
It depends. Typically, I try to do it on that half month with the county. We'd go 2 weeks after they did. And since November, December, we've picked it up. We've added additional beaches. We saw a great need to kind of verify what's going on.
Why is it dangerous for swimmers? I mean, just besides the fact that it sounds gross, but what's the danger to people to be exposed to some of these bacteria?
Well, it depends on the person, of course. Like the young, the aged, and the immunocompromised are especially at risk. But there's anything from gastrointestinal upsets to ear infections, eye infections, sinus infections. I can speak personally from being in dirty water in Hawaii, where I had a sinus infection that I wished I was dead. It was horrible.
You know, because again, you're the one who's out there in the water. I'm just curious, you know, does the water look really bad? Does it look, can you tell just by looking at it, not just testing it, but looking at it, I wouldn't want to get in this water?
Usually not. And that's the bad part. It looks pretty, just like pretty normal water. It doesn't have an acute smell. It doesn't look tinged or brown or anything. It just looks like water. And I mean, it has to be, you have to be sitting pretty close to the pipes to see a difference in the color of the water.
And when you go out and test, Mike, are you just right there along the shore? Do you go out a bit?
We test now on the end of a pole. I've got I wouldn't touch that with a 6-foot pole. Well, we have a 6-foot pole. And we put our sample bag, which is, of course, sterile, on the end of the pole, and then we dip it in. We usually go 6 inches deep. And that gets us away from any structures, because occasionally the structures can actually influence the count. Sometimes bacteria has a tendency to cling to things and you know, colonize it. And that can skew the report. So getting it out a little further really opens it up to, you know, being more correct.
Brooke, what has the Broward Department of Health said about, you know, the lack of swimming advisories or closures, again, despite the unhealthy levels that have been found?
In Broward, they will not answer our questions. The spokesperson there, Candy Sims, refers us to the Healthy Beaches program website, which is often, you know, out of date. The you know, levels that are up there aren't always the most current ones. The state, it's really a State Department program. So the State Department, you know, has talked to us. They have, you know, their offices in each county. So the state folks tell us that, you know, geography has something to do with it, whether you're testing, you know, estuaries, inlets, or open water. But they don't have a good map for which beaches they test. I believe they test 13 in Broward. But, you know, they don't have, like, a good reason for whether so few are in Broward versus Palm Beach and Dade.
Is that normal, though, that the county's Department of Health doesn't even want to answer the question?
Unfortunately, it kind of is. They don't answer a lot of our questions on a couple of different topics, but, you know, primarily this one, they just refer us to the website.
Did the state officials have any answer as to why there were a lot more advisories and closures in Palm Beach County and Miami-Dade County? The Broward is sandwiched in between the two, but for some reason, they don't have as many advisories. Are they supposed to be cleaner?
Right. No, there's no indication that they're, you know, cleaner necessarily. And the state people, you know, wouldn't say whether or not that, you know, what exactly was going on as far as the process. The rules are kind of funny, and they're not, you know, super strictly enforced. So, for example, in Palm Beach County, they choose to notify the public the first time they get a poor sample. And in Broward and Miami-Dade, they choose to retest the water, and they won't issue an advisory until the second poor sample. So initially, that's why we thought we were seeing a lot more in Palm Beach County, but you still see, you know, a lot in Miami as well. So,
Mike, considering you've been doing this work for the Surfrider Foundation for a while now, do you think 2019 was it particularly troubling year compared to other years?
I think in the city of Fort Lauderdale, it's been more troubling because they've had infrastructure issues. And it's very unfortunate. Like in the case of George English, I was asked by Paddle 954, which is a group of paddleboarders that like flat water because they're racers, and they launch right basically maybe 100 yards up the beach or up the canal across from George English. And we were getting unholy numbers, like 900s and greater.
Quickly remind people what's unsafe. What's considered unsafe?
60.
60, and you found in some places over 900.
Yeah, and you know, we found that troubling, and we kept, because it was so troubling, we kept testing it. We wanted an answer. We'd test upstream and downstream. We'd test on different tides. Like if we're going to go upstream, we'd go on an incoming tide. If we're testing downstream, we'd go on an outgoing tide. So that could skew the day, like 8 or 10 hours by the time you collected at the optimum point, because we wanted to have the best information possible to protect the public. And, you know, it's just we kept on seeing spiked rates right behind this church where these guys paddle, and it's directly across the street or across the canal, sorry, river from the from George English Park. So we found that troubling, and we co-sampled with the city of Fort Lauderdale 3 times. The city of Fort Lauderdale is also now testing, and they think they see some value to testing as well. But they wanted to co-test with us to make sure that we were coming out with similar results. They didn't want, you know, as a citizen scientist, as what we Surfrider calls the Blue Water Task Force, you know, we're not certified laboratories, and that if push ever came to shove, I think would be discounted heavily.
Right. Mike, have you ever gone out and just talked to people because you know what you're finding? And as you said, it's not like you could really see it or smell it. But have you ever just gone out and seen people in the water and kind of said to them, I don't think you really want to be in that water?
I have, especially while collecting samples, seen like kayakers or paddleboarders go by, and I'm going, you really ought to think about what you're doing. Get back to wherever you launched from and put it away and go find someplace. The ocean's typically way cleaner than the backwaters are. And I think when I said 60 was the number, that's for the ocean. For the class 2 waterways like the New River, the intercoastal waterways, I think it's 130.
I'm talking with Mike Scully, member of the Broward chapter of the Surfrider Foundation, also talking with Brooke Badinger from the Sun Sentinel. We're talking about the concerns surrounding beaches and ocean water quality in Broward County, as again, sewage and plumbing remain a critical problem in that region. Brooke, what were the particular stretches of beaches or places that were really bad? I mean, Mike kind of told us a little bit there. Some of the rivers really are really bad.
Yeah, it's pretty consistent. You know, in Palm Beach County, you see them in, I think it's called DuBois Park in Jupiter, Phil Foster in Riviera. In Miami-Dade, it's the beaches on Key Biscayne, Crandon Park specifically. And Broward, you know, you don't necessarily know because they don't always have, you know, the updated data. But the data from 2019 seems to show near the outflow pumps in Pompano Beach and Hollywood.
Do we know, Brooke, if these sewage breaks that we keep hearing about, are they connected to the higher amounts of bacteria in the beaches? Is it getting out to the waterways that way?
What we know is that those waterways, you know, eventually do connect into the ocean. And the health department in Broward started testing twice per week instead of only once when they started having those sewage breaks. So, I mean, it affects, you know, different areas. It might not reach one of the 13 beaches where Broward tests, which is where you would have, you know, an organization like Surfriders come in and they can test at those other locations.
Mike, you talked about discussing with Fort Lauderdale officials. I wondered if you've spoken with more than just that, more than maybe county officials as well, about the kind of stuff that you have found in your testing, just to see, you know, if again, there's just going to be, if officials are going to take this a little more seriously.
I've reached out a couple of times and I've been unsuccessful so far. I have talked to people up in Palm Beach only because, like, we've known each other since the woman was a very young child. So, you know, I was actually using her for some leverage to get to Broward County's health department, but it didn't quite work as well as I thought it might have.
And, you know, during the times you've done your testing, especially, you know, look, during the really busy tourist seasons, have you seen days where you're out there testing and there's just a ton of people in the water and you know in your heart that's risky, they shouldn't be out there?
Yeah, well, I really don't know that. It's different every day. And the problem with the testing that we all use, the city, the county, Surfrider, is based on collecting the sample and incubating it for 24 hours, and that's when we get our result. That's how we know how many colony-forming units are in each 100 milliliters of
water. Yeah, but you told me that you wouldn't even get in the water. You wouldn't touch it with a 6-foot pole.
Yeah, well, I use the pole, but I'm getting the water. I was talking about up the river.
I see.
When it was obviously problematic. But in the ocean is almost always, you know, blue.
Okay. Mike, why are you doing this, by the way?
Because I've lived in Florida my whole life, and I've surfed since 63. And I know some people that have had issues, you know, with their, you know, sinus infections and things like that. And anything we can do to prevent it, you know, Surfrider, I joined Surfrider because they try to protect the ocean. They try to protect the access, public's access to the beaches. And I mean, that was the whole premise of Surfrider in 1984 when it started.
And so far in 2020, you know, just the tests that you've done, maybe you've had a couple at least so far. Is it better or worse?
The one place that we tested quite a bit was by George English, and it got better, and then it got worse. So, and I think that, you know, we were kind of linking the fact that we're telling the city that there's got to be a leak here somewhere prior to the first failure at George English. And we started seeing elevator results again, and we were saying there's got to be another leak. You know, so the pipes were leaking before they burst is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and as reported, again, another sewage pipe break. At, you know, in that neighborhood, the George English Park near an elementary school. And, you know, just as I mentioned, we do have our reporter out there. We're going to get more information about that. We'll be reporting it throughout the day. Brooke, you know what? After the story came out, I mean, did that spark anything? Have you heard anything else from city or county officials?
No, not from officials. Heard a lot from, you know, readers, but nothing from official sources.
And what did you hear from readers? What are they telling you?
Just that they can't believe it, that they can't believe that, you know, there could be potentially harmful bacteria in the ocean that they're, you know, going into and they wouldn't even know about it.
At this point, I mean, what's some of the follow-up reporting that you're going to do on this story? What more do you want to find?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to keep following up, especially, you know, as we see more and more breaks in Fort Lauderdale. And then, you know, when we start to get into the rainy season in the summers, you'll probably start to see more advisories then, too. So just I'm going to keep following it.
What would you, and I want to hear from both of you on this. What would you tell anyone who wants to go out into the waterways as to what they should be looking for? Because if those advisories are not up, is there something they could at least see or smell or tell, then maybe it's not safe to get into the water, or maybe, you know, for not too long?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to know what to do. What I've heard is just like call the health department and ask on any given day. But, you know, as far as looking at the Healthy Beaches website, it might not always be up to date. So what about you, Mike?
I think
Brooke's
article really opened a door there. I mean, I was walking down the street and I had a guy stop me and ask me if I was the guy that was testing the water. I said, yeah. He asked me, you know. So I think the more awareness on the part of the public, the public becomes self-protective. You know, you don't have to depend on signs. You know, they can kind of use their heads. And if there's been a lot of sewage on the rivers, that some of that is going to end up on the beaches.
You know, Mike. Yeah, from you, I wanted to know because look, you've been out there for years and years. As you said, you've been surfing for a long time, and so for you, you appreciate the water, you know, in ways that most people don't. But what worries you most about, you know, all the things that you've seen change over the years, the beaches especially?
It's become a dead zone. There's a lot less fish. There's a lot less activity out in the water. And that's one thing that I find troubling. And certainly if somebody got ill, you know, people have died from this same kind of thing. It's happened in Hawaii a couple of times, or MRSA and things like that. More serious than just, you know, a gastrointestinal infection or, you know, a ear infection. It can get way more serious depending on the person and the amount of bacteria. So I would like the city or the county, probably anybody, to go ahead and maybe have the lifeguards be more informed and have the lifeguards call some of the tourists out. I know the Chamber of Commerce probably is not it's not their favorite idea, but it would protect, especially at elevated levels, the public.
This is an amazing story. Again, something you don't think much about, but also good to know that you don't always see or smell something, and that doesn't mean that there isn't a risk. We've been talking with Mike Scully, member of the Broward chapter of the Surf Rider Foundation, and Brooke Badinger from the Sun Sentinel. Mike, Brooke, thank you so much for the information.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And, you know, we'd love to hear from you as well. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. If maybe you've been out in the water recently and something, you got sick, something hit you. Did you see any advisories out there? Is there enough information to let you know if the water is safe? Again, at WLRN Sundial, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Well, still to come, what can dinosaurs teach us about climate change? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A new exhibition at the Museum of Discovery and Science in Fort Lauderdale explores our fascination with dinosaurs. Through animatronic displays and different devices used by paleontologists in the field, the museum is hoping to inspire a generation of children to pursue a career in science. For Joe Cox, the CEO of the museum, it was a passion that began for him at a very young age. He grew up in Dorset, England, the home of Mary Anning, who is widely considered the founder of paleontology. We spoke with Cox last month about the exhibition and how he hopes that it could also teach children about the issue of climate change.
When you look at fossil records, you know, we can use things like which plants were here to really help build that understanding of climate. So we're able to figure out, you know, what were these animals eating? How did we put together the kind of biogeography of the system based on those?
In this exhibit, what are some of the dinosaurs that you're going to be highlighting? What's some of the stuff that you're going to be highlighting?
So we have a dozen different dinosaurs, from the ones you're going to recognize, the velociraptors, the stegosauruses, the triceratops, to some that you may not have heard of before. So Carnotaurus, Amargosaurus. So there's some really interesting ones that may not be kind of top of mind. You know, everyone knows their T-Rex, everyone knows their Triceratops, but you know, this definitely has a few new ones as well.
And you also, part of the exhibit I notice is it's showing the life of, you know, the people who are out there digging for these fossils.
It does, because, you know, one of the things we really want to do, and I think this exhibit does really well, is introduce our visitors to the skills that they might need to be a paleontologist, to be a scientist, to be a researcher, to understand, you know, how you put together facts and kind of what it takes to piece together a story. And so we do. We start the exhibit in the past, and we look at some of the great dinosaur fossil hunters here in the U.S. and what tools they would have had out in the field. And some of the tools are very, very similar to the same tools you'd use today. You know, it's backpacks, it's journals, it's tiny hammers and chisels and brushes, because it's a very delicate work. You've, you know, got to take the time to really be careful that you're doing this well. And so it takes you through comparisons of then and now, and there's a lot of similarities, but then we get back into the lab, and that's where the differences really start to come out.
And the dinosaurs that you have, these are animatronics. So, they're basically robots, and they move. I also noticed a couple of them, you can actually move them. You can push the buttons and make them do things.
You can. So, you know, the museum's all about, you know, hands-on interactivity. So in this exhibit, too, visitors are allowed to come in and manipulate the actions of the dinosaurs. Some of them have motion sensors on. So as you walk past, they come to life. Maybe I shouldn't tell you that. But no, it really is. And of course, then visitors can also see permanent dinosaur collection, where we have a small permanent dinosaur collection that has a T-Rex skull and Triceratops skull, dinosaur eggs, and kind of explore what we have here at the museum year-round.
You mentioned it a couple times, so let's get into it. The issue of climate change. How are you going to bring the issue up in, you know, when you're talking about dinosaurs and the different dinosaur eras to what we know today about the issue of climate change and how it impacts us?
You know, climate change and resiliency are so key to us here in South Florida. And being able to use fossils to study climate. You know, weather's what happens outside every day. Climate is what happens over long periods of time, decades, millennia, eons. And so we can look at this and we can study. You know, you can go back millions of years and look at, you know, core samples that have been taken in Greenland that show you carbon dioxide levels versus heat temperatures around the world and see the correlation. And, okay, where does that become different? That becomes different when human CO2 level started to just explode. And so using data, using research, really understanding, you know, facts. So the exhibit doesn't get into why or how or if or but it's really about giving kids the skills to understand that they should do the research.
And that's the other thing. This is a very complex issue. So how do you present it for children so it's digestible and interesting? It's going to be fun.
And I think it all has to start with earth science. You know, earth science and the understanding of geology, of our planet, of our world. You know, it's really hard to understand climate change if you don't understand how the world works. And so that's where we start with really elementary earth science conversations.
I'm talking with Joe Cox, President and CEO of the Museum of Discovery and Science in Fort Lauderdale. They have a new exhibition. It's called Expedition Dinosaur, and it's on display now through May 25th. You can find photos and videos on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Also a part of the exhibit, and any exhibit like this, is to open up the possibility for kids to be interested in different sciences, paleontology, etc. Do you get the sense kids today are still interested in this, considering we live in this very high-tech world and a lot of kids' attention tends to be on a screen? But are they still interested in this stuff?
I think so. I mean, I think if you look at attendance numbers of museums where they have dinosaur exhibits or special dinosaur exhibits, the Smithsonian just opened a spectacular new dinosaur exhibit. Museum store sales, dinosaurs are always really popular. My 4.5-year-old niece and nephew love their dinosaurs. I think it's just one of those things that it's so awe-inspiring and so magnificent and so exciting. Opening up in February, first dinosaur IMAX that's been made in 10 years. Imagine sitting in our IMAX theater and seeing a life-size dinosaur come roaring towards you, based on, you know, National Science Foundation funded research. It's going to be spectacular. And I think museums do that, right? Museums are a place where, you know, we inspire that sense of discovery. And, you know, our mission is connecting people to inspiring science. What's more inspiring than coming face to face with a dinosaur, but also being given the tools to understand how you could become a paleontologist?
And the exhibit also focuses on new technology that's being used in paleontology. I mean, you talked about the old tools, but technology is playing a big role today.
It really is, and everything from LIDAR scans to identify fossil sites, 3D scanning of actual fossils to really understand them, preserve them, study them without, you know, damaging them, because, you know, they can often be fragile, often be heavy, you know, being able to replicate them and do really authentic 3D replicas of fossils so that they can be shared and studied, you know, being able to manipulate them digitally to see how their bodies moved, how they actually stood, how they walked, how they run, you know, what their colors may have been. You know, that's one of the most fascinating things to me is I grew up with these gray, blocky dinosaurs, and they were all gray and all the same color. And, you know, now we know that in all likelihood, dinosaurs were, you know, every color of the rainbow. If they had feathers, we look at birds in the world today, why would they not have been as resplendent as, you know, a quetzal or a parrot or a hummingbird?
I heard you say when you were walking us through the tour that we're making a lot of new discoveries all the time. I mean, it seems like, I mean, we've discovered so much, but really, there's still a lot more to uncover. There's still a lot more to dig up.
There really is. You know, some of the statistics as to, you know, what it takes for an animal to have been fossilized, you know, whether it's one in a million, one in X million, you know, what we know of the world, you know, we literally, when you look at paleontologists out in the field, we're literally scratching the surface. And so there's so much more to be discovered, you know, with plate tectonics and how the world has shifted over time, what has been buried, what has been destroyed. They're still pulling, you know, prehistoric animals out of the La Brea tar pits. So there's a lot more to be discovered. There's a lot more opportunities for paleontologists. And, you know, we hope that one of the kids walking through the museum today ends up being a paleontologist that makes a huge discovery 20 years down the road.
So that means there could be dinosaurs we haven't discovered yet.
Oh, I'm sure there are dinosaurs we haven't discovered yet. You know, every day we're finding bigger, larger, smaller, more bizarre options. So, yeah, there's a lot more out there to be discovered.
Last thing, your favorite dinosaur and why?
My favorite dinosaur is absolutely a Stegosaurus. Growing up, I always thought they were just so cool with the plates. And, you know, there they are, the nice little herbivores running around, doing their own quiet life. And then I was very fortunate to work at a wonderful museum in Massachusetts, the Ecotarium, where they had a model of a Stegosaurus who was part of the 1964-65 World's Fair in New York. So he was very much a mascot of the city, and I got to have a dinosaur of my own for a while. So Stegosaurus all the way.
That's a good one, but I'll still stick with a T-Rex. That was Joe Cox, president and CEO of the Museum of Discovery and Science in Fort Lauderdale. You can see a video of our visit and photos by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, dinosaurs are one way to learn about the environment and climate change, and another comes from the reporting that we do here at WLRN. Did you know you could subscribe to a weekly newsletter with the highlights of our environment reporting? Just sign up, text the words EnviroNews to 305-363-6687. Again, EnviroNews to 305-363-6687. 6687. And a lot of you have been sending us your questions. Our engagement editor, Katie Lepre, brought some of those to WLRN's environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovich.
We asked our listeners to send in their questions about climate change and sea level rise, and I wanted to share a couple with you. This one is from Marika Lynch. She asks, what can we expect from climate change in the next 5, 10, or even 15 years?
Many of the models project way out into the future for climate change because it is sort of a slow-moving disaster. But some of the near-term impacts are going to be we'll continue to see sunny day flooding. The coastal flooding is probably going to get worse. We've already seen water levels around here creep up about 8 inches in the last couple of decades. I think what will become more evident to the general public, though, is sort of the response to that. There are plans in place now that are supposed to play out faster than sea rise and some of the impacts from climate change. So, for example, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is right now looking at not just Miami-Dade County, but Monroe County, Broward County, Pumpkin County, all around the Florida coast at ways that they can protect areas from storm surge, which is expected to get worse as seas rise. So, you know, they're talking about massive floodgates across the Miami River, the Indian River, I'm sorry, the Miami River, the Little River, not the Indian River, and also raising, you know, putting in flood walls through neighborhoods. They're talking about elevating thousands and thousands of homes. This is a big, complicated, and very expensive plan that is going to take a while to unfold, but they're talking about having the first draft of that plan ready to present to the public this spring.
We received a question from a woman named Marie DeCowden. She actually asked about a specific plan for one city. She said, does Miami have a plan for sea rise for the future as New York does? If so, what is it? If not, why not?
Miami is working on a plan now. They just last month incorporated this big document into their strategy, their capital strategy going forward. And part of that plan, probably I think one of the most significant parts is the stormwater system. As they increase pumping to keep streets dry, they're going to be putting a lot of dirty street water into the bay. And so they have to take a look at what is an aging stormwater system to figure out how it's going to handle even more water coming in and also not do damage to the bay. Biscayne Bay is already, NOAA told us a couple months ago, it's in danger or it's undergoing a regime shift. So we are moving away from our beautiful clear water with rolling seagrass meadows to murky water filled with macroalgae.
So Joshua emailed us, when did the term king tide first appear?
Well, I would say that meteorologists have always called these tides that occur at different lunar cycles king tides. When it entered popular jargon or the lexicon is probably a factor of these sunny day floods, like when they started getting worse and more apparent. You know, when people started noticing them, then you saw the phrase.
I mean, he points out in his message, he's like, I don't remember its existence 18 years ago.
So I grew up in South Florida, too, and I don't remember ever hearing anything about king tides growing up. We certainly had high tides. I lived in a house on a little canal in Fort Lauderdale, and some days the tide would be up over the dock, and it was sunny out. Again, I'm going to say meteorologists probably referred to this as king tides, but we just didn't know. But I will also say that those tides were way more infrequent. And when the frequency picked up, that's when you started, I think when the phrase king tides started, sort of entered the common discourse.
That was our engagement editor, Katie Lepre, speaking with our environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. Remember, you could sign up for the environment newsletter. Just text the words EnviroNews to 305-363-6687. And that's Sundial for this Monday, February 24th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandro Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Don't forget, you can always find and download a podcast of this program. Search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, we all know how expensive housing is in South Florida, but our situation is getting national attention. The Urban Land Institute is hosting a symposium in Miami this week with leaders from the U.S. Department of Housing to the rental company Zillow. And we're going to learn why South Florida has become a case study for housing issues on a national scale. Plus, have you heard of Florida's PACE program? It's a lending program for homeowners to install energy-efficient or hurricane-resistant additions. Well, a new study finds that it's contributing billions of dollars to Florida's economy, but some political leaders are skeptical of its lending practices. We'll learn more about that coming up tomorrow. Finally, a new exhibition in the Everglades explores the history of Florida's freed slaves. We're going to meet the artist behind the project. And don't forget, we have a book club, and we have been reading Craig Pittman's Cattail this month. This week, we're going to announce the March book. Also on Thursday, we're going to hear from one of the characters in Craig's book. I'm not going to tell you which one, but trust me, you're going to enjoy it. Again, we've been reading Cat's Tail. Find us on Facebook. Ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. Let us know what you're reading. And again, this week, we're going to announce the March title for the Sundial Book Club. Thanks so much for listening. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.